Open up the human services on Wednesday, April 27th, 2011, and we'll open up an informational hearing on the lottery and gambling addiction services. So I think we have three presenters, right? Why don't you come all up at once, and then we'll hear from you as you desire. Is there anyone else here who wishes to speak also, besides the three that we have invited testimony? Guess not. Okay. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, committee members. For the record, my name is Carol Hardy. I'm the Assistant Director for Marketing for the Oregon Lottery, and I also serve as the Chair of the Oregon Council on Problem Gambling. And we were asked to come here this morning to do a high-level overview of where lottery profits go in the state and then focus specifically on responsible gambling and treatment. That's my understanding.
Great. Thank you.
There is a handout. Is that what I do? All right. So the Oregon Lottery dollars. So since 1985, which when the lottery officially opened, we have transferred over $7.5 billion in lottery dollars. Last year, we had $1 billion in sales and transferred over $526 million. This is our fifth consecutive year of over $1 billion in sales. The lottery returns nearly 97% of every dollar to Oregon in the form of profits and prizes. If you look at the next page, the current Oregon lottery profit allocation is shown in the form of a pie chart. Education receives 61% of our profits, economic development 23%, salmon habitat restoration 7.5%, state park 7.5%, and problem gambling treatment 1%.
So could you talk for a minute about the places where the gambling is done, the bars, taverns, restaurants, or whatever? Could you talk about what their profits are?
Talk about how many there are? Is that the question?
Well, that's a good question, too, okay. But what their profits are.
So we have approximately 2,300 retailers that sell both video and traditional lottery games, and we have an additional 1,700 that sell only our traditional games, so that would be like Powerball, Mega Millions, scratch tickets. Our traditional retailers are paid on a sliding scale based on their sales between 5 and 10% of gross revenue, gross sales for those products. Video lottery is calculated differently. It's actually a declining scale. The more they sell, the lower their commission rate. So video lottery retailers on an average right now have 22% of net sales. So the two are difficult to compare. One's based on gross sales that has prizes included. The other is net with prizes paid out. So I didn't come prepared with a lot of figures based on that, but that's the distinction between the two types of products that we offer.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yes.
Can we follow?
Sure, absolutely.
That didn't help at all.
Okay.
Question is, how much money on average do they make per machine of video poker?
Representative Greenlee, Chair Tomei, that every retailer is different, so I didn't come prepared with average revenues, average commissions for the retailers, and it varies greatly because it depends on their sales level, whether it's a traditional product or video. If they're a low seller, their commission is based on a percentage of that dollar amount. So, again, I didn't bring those figures with me. We'd be happy to share something with you that was relative to lottery commissions, but I didn't bring those figures with me.
Fair.
So it is a sliding scale that varies widely depending on their sales level.
I frankly can't believe you don't know the answer to that question, but it would be very helpful if you tried to deliver us the answer to that question,
sure.
Which is a very simple question. What's the average profit per machine on a video poker machine?
So the average profit per machine is a different question than what our lottery retailers make. So how payouts are constructed on a video lottery terminal is that the games are scheduled to pay back 93% to the player. So that means that there is 7% that we operate our business on. So of that 7%, That's made up of covering the lottery's administrative costs, and part of that is what we pay the retailer commissions, and the remainder is what comes back in profits.
Madam Chair, may I follow up?
Absolutely.
This is an amazing conversation. I don't know if everybody else is finding it as amazing as I am. Let me try one more time, and let me see if I can use English this time. What's the average profit per machine that your retailers make on a video poker machine? Very simple. That's in dollars. What is your average across your 2,300 people that have those machines? What's their average per machine?
I apologize, but that is, it ranges widely from maybe 10,000 to hundreds of thousands, depending on their sales volume. So an average would be a precise figure that I just don't have it in front of me.
Oh.
And literally, it's a chart that you can look retailer by retailer, which we're happy to provide. It's just the question about specifically.
Fine, send me the 2,300. Send us the 2,300s one at a time, and I'll divide by 2,300. If that's what you're saying, you don't have the mechanics to do this.
So we'll be happy to send that to you.
And it would be interesting to me. We have one Amazing. That's called Foxy's that actually is their business. So I'd be interested in having the figures on what Foxy's, I think there's another one called Dottie's. Maybe
it is Dottie's, yeah.
Yeah,
yes.
That are really, these are the businesses. That's how they make their money. So if you could give us those figures, just point those out. I think that would give us some idea. Because I think there probably are some places like in Eastern Oregon there might be
right.
one or two that probably wouldn't get a whole lot of business. But these Foxy's and Dottie's get a lot of business, so it'd be interesting to know that.
So if we can provide the data in different formats so that it's easy to digest, we can certainly come up with an average, but that is something that just I don't have off the top of my head.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Was there any other questions? Yes, Representative Widener.
I was just going to follow up because I understand how hard it would be for different facilities and to calculate, but it's basically 7% per machine, so every $100 is $7. It goes back to the lottery. The person who has the machine gets 25% of that or 20% of that.
Yes, that's accurate.
So you're looking at about $2 or $2.50 per 100 that goes into a machine that is paid back to the person. Now, have sales went down on the machines since we basically eliminated smoking from indoor facilities?
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen a reduction in play?
Yes, Representative Widener, Chair Tomei. We saw over a 20% decline in video lottery sales in combination with the smoking ban and the economic downturn, which really came at the same time. So what was on about a 4 to 5% annual upward trend, we saw a 20% decline.
Has that gone up in the last 6 months or year?
Representative Tomei, that has become level now. So what was in a decline, we are this year about 1% year over year ahead of last year with video lottery sales.
Thanks.
If I may on that one.
Sure.
Because this is kind of a little pet peeve of mine a little bit when we passed that bill. The people that sat and they would play the machines and they would smoke, now they're standing in front of the establishment smoking. So I guess we've kind of helped with lottery addiction by sending them outside so all of our children can see them standing in front of the facility smoking cigarettes. So now that we're glorifying smoking out to the whole world rather than keeping it inside an establishment. So I think we've created another set of problems by eliminating smoking indoors. So that's my pet peeve, and I'll get off my horse. And it wasn't even a question. I was just making a statement. So as I drive by and see people standing in front of the facility smoking now.
Representative Harker, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of quick minor points. Transfers are what you call, that's the lingo for moving money into other areas, education, etc. Correct?
Transfers are the same as profits, so whatever we don't pay out in prizes and whatever we're not retaining for our administrative expenses are transfers, which are our profits, yes.
Into other portions of our state government?
It's transferred actually to the Economic Development Fund, which the legislature is responsible
okay.
for allocating.
And when your last bullet on the first slide is about returning 97 cents on the dollar, and that's of each dollar gambled, correct?
Each dollar played, yes.
Played, okay. Thanks.
Which means that we operate around 3% from an administrative expenses perspective. Any more questions?
Any more questions? Thank you so much. Go ahead.
So just a little more detail on the different categories of where the profits go. Public education, again, gets 61% of the profits. That's over $4.4 billion since 1995, which was when 18% was constitutionally dedicated to the Education Stability Fund. Lottery profits provide textbooks, equipment, salaries for teachers. The lottery isn't responsible for how that money is used. We just transfer it, to be clear. The other category, state parks, receives 7.5%. That's over $370 million since 1999. Again, that is now constitutionally dedicated. Lottery profits help provide new parklands, ability to keep parks open year-round, yurts, hiking trails. These are just some of the specific funding projects that have been funded with lottery profits. 7% also goes to watershed enhancement and salmon habitat restoration. Again, that's constitutionally dedicated and represents $370 million since 1999. Profits in that category have gone towards restoring wildlife habitat, removing invasive plants, and improving water quality. Another category is economic development, which currently receives about 23% of lottery profits, which represents over $1.9 billion since 1985. That was the original purpose for the Oregon Lottery that was in the bills that established it was for economic development. Lottery profits help create jobs by attracting new businesses to Oregon, helping existing companies grow, creating a skilled workforce, a variety of programs that are actively trying to help our economy. The last category, which I was going to focus a bit more on, is responsible gambling. 1% of lottery profits is dedicated to fund treatment programs throughout the state. And that is dedicated by statute. That is something that the legislature is actively involved in. The lottery actively works to balance our mission, which is to maximize revenue while minimizing the impact of problem gambling. So we make a choice to use a portion of our administrative money to create a balance. So lottery dedicates approximately $2 million annually to public outreach programs. We collaborate with different groups within the state. I'd mentioned I'm the chair on the Oregon Council for Problem Gambling. One of the members is Dr. Jeff Murata, who you may be familiar with, who used to work for the Department of Human Services as the Problem Gambling Services Manager. He now has a consulting company. We have a contract with him that helps guide our messaging development. We also actively work with the current DHS Responsible Gambling, Problem Gambling Group within that area. We also work with the Oregon Council, who conducts research studies. We help fund those studies so that we are trying to get the best information to help us understand how we can do effective outreach. We use multimedia to try to reach the public and try to educate them about the issues of problem gambling and the help that's available. So we use television, print, outdoor, interactive media, trying to find the folks that we're trying to reach. Our retailers are contractually obligated to provide information related to responsible gambling. They are contractually obligated to cut someone off from gambling if they're visibly intoxicated. We have a comprehensive staff training program available that, again, Dr. Murata helped us craft that training program. And we do have an annual target to try to increase the calls to the helpline by 10% every year. We believe that there is only a portion of the population that we currently reach that really could be helped by treatment. So our goal is to provide messaging out in the marketplace to try to encourage them to call.
Has that happened? Have you increased the calls to the helpline?
Chair Tomei, years past, year over year, we have seen different numbers. We increased calls between 10 and 22% trying to think back at when the years would have been. It was really in the early 2000s when we saw the economic downturn hit and the smoking ban hit. We have actually fallen short of the 10% increase in calls to treatment. We do have a good methodology of tracking that, because one of the things that the Problem Gambling Treatment Fund funds is a 24-hour helpline who's contract with DHS, and they give us reports that when our ads are on the air, they tell us whether there was an increase in call. So we believe that trend is based on the economic downturn and the smoking ban, that those calls have actually gone down. There's no other variable that we can identify. So we continue to try to achieve that. However, we have not changed our measure. The other thing that we do is we believe it's our responsibility to encourage players to set limits. This is a worldwide practice that seems to be the best practice for trying to get people to think about gambling different, is if we encourage them to set limits and stick to budgets, those are the most effective measures of getting people to manage their play. As such, when we moved to having line games on our video lottery terminals, we provided time of day clocks so that people will have a tool to not lose track of time. All of the credits that are in a VLT are also represented as dollars, so that it is clear that they're playing with money, so they can see how much money that they have spent. As I mentioned, our retailers are responsible for posting materials related to the help related to VLTs. These are a sample of some materials that were just produced that promote the helpline, the 24-hour helpline. They promote the website, where there is a chat feature where people can go online and actually chat to try to get help. There's brochures that our retailers are responsible for posting. And on every VLT, we post the helpline number. So that concludes my presentation. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Hardy. That was very helpful. Do you have any questions? I'd like to know how, and I'm not sure if somebody here can answer that, how effective all these are. And as I walk into these places like Boxy's and Dottie's, I'm wondering, as I see people gambling, do they look at the clocks? Do they look at the dollars? Do they the helpline? I remember when we posted years ago on cigarettes that, you know, this is dangerous to your health. I think people don't see that or pay attention to that. What is there anything on these machines that people do pay attention to that makes them think about what they're doing and how much they're putting into that machine? And how helpful are the brochures and the TV ads, et cetera? You know, we're looking at evidence-based practices. That's what we're talking about in healthcare and in mental health care. So what I'd like the committee to hear is how effective are these things that we're trying to do to control problem gambling. So if anybody can answer that, or if that in your presentation, if you can respond to that would be great.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Tim Murphy. I'm the executive director of Bridgeway Recovery Services, located here in Salem. Bridgeway Recovery Services is a private nonprofit clinic for the treatment of folks with substance abuse addictions, mental health issues, and problem gambling. We have outpatient services and residential services for problem gambling, and are the only problem gambling residential problem gambling treatment program in the Northwest. We operate with a contract through Marion County and the state for problem gambling treatment for Oregon. We also have one for the state of Washington as well. So I came to talk a little bit about what we see in our clinic every day. And you know, the lottery does great things, and I'm really not here to talk about the lottery as much as I am to talk about what happens to individuals that suffer from either problem gambling or pathological gambling. And when we diagnose folks with the gambling disorders, it really comes down to those two distinctions, and I can talk a little bit about the difference between those. But our recent data is showing that there's probably 70,000 people in Oregon that suffer from problem gambling, and a subset of those meet the diagnostic criteria for pathological gambling. And the real distinction there is how much their gambling behavior has disrupted their lives and caused problems for them in their everyday life and daily functioning. And those are the folks that we generally see in a residential setting. Those are that have been diagnosed and meet criteria for pathological gambling. The data is pretty clear. We've been collecting it. One thing Oregon does really well is collect data. We've got lots of data about people that enter our services for a variety of reasons and from throughout the state. So those questions we can answer quite distinctly. I enjoyed the conversation a minute ago about the settings where people go to gamble. I always thought it was a mistake that we put the machines in bars because the bars get the profit that Representative Greenlick was asking about. Mm-hmm. Had we put those machines in churches, it would have been a whole different setting and we may have been able to fund things differently as a result. But somehow that didn't happen. Maybe the churches would have had a difficulty with it. I would like to talk a little bit about the type of people we see at the really extreme end of the gambling continuum, those that come to us here in Salem and enter residential treatment for pathological gambling. And what we've learned in studies over the last 10 years about gambling behavior through brain scans neurological work with folks that have severe gambling behaviors is that there's a mechanism in the brain that gets affected that's very similar to the same mechanism that is affected when people have addiction to cocaine and methamphetamine. And through brain scans, you will actually see that area of the brain get activated when they're playing a machine. Doesn't happen to everybody. Most of the people that play these machines probably can play $2 or $3 and walk away. But there's a significant number of people that have problems related to their gambling behaviors. And in a group of those, their behaviors are so extreme that we see high suicide rates, comorbidity of high physical health problems, to the point where I had to bring in a nurse and a physician to address the medical needs of the people that are coming to us with pathological gambling diagnosis and designations. So we're seeing people carrying extreme debt loads as a result of their gambling behavior. If you'll give me a minute, I can just tell you a quick story of a woman that was with us for over 60 days. 62 years old, retired, 25 years working for a metropolitan hospital in a series of administrative jobs. Her husband, 65 years old, retired from Department of Transportation. He retired a few years earlier than she did. He took into golf and fly fishing and hunting with his buddies. She continued to work, and when we had her, when she came to us and we had her list the things that she enjoyed in life, she enjoyed her grandchildren, stories, and her games. When we asked about stories, Archie wasn't on the top of the list, but when we asked about stories, it was soap operas. I didn't know they were called stories, but they're called stories. And then games, when we asked about games, it wasn't Monopoly and cards, it was video poker. And what she had developed over a series of years was watching her stories in the afternoon and then going out into a local tavern and playing games. And it started out pretty innocently, and her husband would join her at times, and it continued to occupy more and more of her time. She went through all of their retirement savings. She ended up losing their home. They mortgaged their home, lost their home, moved in with children, lost all of the finances that they had, ended up in our clinic with severe hypertension and anxiety. Husband very distraught. He had to return to work as a result of this, and she completed our treatment, has been gambling free for about 12 months, but I'm worried about her a lot. I don't know that she'll have the ability and the supports to absolutely stay away from the need that she had to daily go and play video poker. And the hard part for her was her husband Archie's understanding love for her and sort of co-involvement in this. He would support her and continue to obtain money and give money to her. So we have the ability not only to work with the problem gambler specifically, but we'll bring in the family members as well. And the way the state of Oregon has funded treatment is it allows us to work with the non-gambling spouse or significant other of people that are suffering from problem gambling. We're successful a pretty good amount of time. About half the time, people at this high-end need report being gambling-free for 12 months. So that's about 48 to 50% of the time we're able to get pretty good reports about abstinence, and another 30% of the time people report continuing to gamble, but gambling at much significant lower levels than before. Funding has fluctuated for the treatment of problem gamblers in the state of Oregon. While there's a 1% dedication, it sort of moves around, Karen can speak to that a little bit clearer than I can. I'm on the receiving end of some of that money, and so sometimes it comes and we're able to support more people, and sometimes it goes away and we have to cut back. We generally have people waiting to get in our doors, and we have a robust outpatient gambling treatment program throughout the state. So around the state, people have access to outpatient services, but if their gambling continues to not be resolved through that sort of treatment intervention, they're referred to us at the residential center. I'm going to stop for a moment and just catch my breath and open
Up
to
any questions so far. We read in the paper occasionally there'll be these little articles about someone who had embezzled hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I remember a few years ago it was a woman who worked for the city of West Lynn and was very well thought of in the community. So I think it's not rare that happens. Occasionally we do see those, and I'm assuming obviously these would be the pathological gamblers.
You're absolutely right, Madam Chair. Not only do you see those high-profile ones, but we also see the folks that embezzle from the Girl Scout cookies, the Little League and soccer teams. It's a surprising number of folks that end up in our shop have very strong law enforcement involvement. They're pending going to jail, or they're coming out of jail, or they're hoping that treatment will keep them out of going to jail when they're being held responsible. But we have data around that involvement as well that we can share with you. And when people complete treatment, we're seeing a drop in criminal activity as well.
Any questions? Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Good morning, Chairs Tomei, Gilliam, members of the committee. My name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addiction Programs Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm responsible for administering the problem gambling treatment and prevention services. Some of the data points have already been covered, so I'll try to not repeat anything that's already been said. You do have a slide presentation or handouts provided to you. I'm going to start basically on slide number 3. Basically, we've given the statutory reference to the 1% lottery revenues and the reference to OHA administering the funds. A majority of these funds are distributed through contracts with community mental health programs or counties. And one important point that I would like to make is that the gambling treatment and prevention system is really more or less an integrated system with addictions and mental health services, so that when one system suffers from any kind of cuts or reductions or stress, it also affects the gambling system, because the providers are essentially the same providers, the mental health providers and the addiction providers. And I would also say that we have done a fairly concentrated, focused effort the last few years to really integrate gambling prevention services into our existing prevention infrastructure for substance abuse and other kinds of prevention. And that's somewhat to your point on evidence-based practices and strategies. We know that people who tend to engage in problem behaviors do so in a more clustered way. So a child or an adolescent who is taking risks with drinking or smoking or using drugs is also more likely to take risks and gamble. And you'll see a slide later on that comes from our student wellness survey. We now do a student wellness survey every other year, and the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey is conducted every other year. And so our survey is very focused on mental health, substance abuse, gambling, and behavioral health issues. So you'll see some interesting data later in a slide.
Next question, this slide.
Yes.
Is that 1% of lottery revenues or 1% of lottery profits, or what is that 1% of?
Lottery profits.
It's the profits.
The profits is a net amount. It's the revenue after expenses. And how much has that been each year for the last 3 years? Sorry.
So if I could point you to slide... co-chairs, Representative Greenlick, we have a biennial budget, and slide number 6 provides you with some historical legislative-approved budgets. So for 09-11, our current biennium, it's $11.5 million, and for the previous biennium, it was $13.1.
Madam Chair, may I follow? There was some question in the testimony in our committee about the difference between the legislatively approved budget and 1% of the profits. Are these numbers really 1% of the profits, or are they what Ways and Means gave you out of lottery profits?
Co-chairs and Representative Greenlick, I know that the funds transferred from the Department of Administrative Services are essentially end up being the revenue that we use for our budget. And I believe that is the 1%. I might
be able to help a little bit. So Chair Tomei and Gilliam, Representative Greenlick, the process is at the beginning of a biennium, the DAS forecasters project lottery revenues. And whatever is the published budget, which is usually based on the May forecast, 1% of the forecasted lottery revenues is set aside to say this is 1% of lottery revenues. So during that biennium, the lottery forecast may vary based on what DAS changes the forecast to be. So that number could go up and down during the course of the biennium. What DHS gets is based on what their budgetary request is. So it could move over the course of the biennium, which I think is why it's difficult to say that that is a consistent number over the course of the biennium. So what may be allocated at the beginning of the biennium could change. Does that help?
Co-chairs and Representative Greenlick, and it does change. The Ways and Means Committee does have the power to remove those funds. And so that's what we saw happen last biennium, was the $1.2 million was removed from the approved budget.
That's my number.
Chair, the reason I asked that is because we had a bill in our committee to put that 1% in as a floor.
Good.
It didn't get out of committee, but we're going to be working on it in the interim. But
good.
Yeah, I think we're not really getting the 1% to spend in this area.
Right. Thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you.
And I meant to thank you for having this hearing, by the way, too, and hearing about the issues related to problem gambling and the services. So moving back to slide number 4, you will see a map of the state of Oregon with all the counties. Again, we basically contract with community mental health programs. We, as was mentioned earlier, we have a contract with Emergence, and they operate the 24-hour hotline. They also, I don't know of any other hotline in the state of Oregon that's doing this, but it, as far as communication with that program, it seems to be pretty effective when people are more comfortable going online versus talking to somebody on the phone. They will do a web chat, and so they can literally get right into a counselor. The 24-hour hotline is staffed by professional gambling counselors. So I've actually tried to call in the middle of the night, and people do answer the phone. And they're very helpful. They are very knowledgeable, and they know everything about the treatment system and the prevention system in terms of getting people access to the right kinds of programs and resources. We contract with the counties. Some of the counties don't deliver the service in their own county, so you'll see little stars that say satellite office. That means that another county provides the service in the neighboring or adjoining county. Because especially in the smaller rural areas, there's not a whole lot of people, frankly, and there's not a whole lot of capacity, so they find ways to be more effective and efficient with their resources. And then I would have to say we have a stellar residential program, and you just heard from Tim Murphy. We are one of the states, I think there's only one or two other states that actually have a residential treatment program for problem gamblers. And I've personally visited the program. I've met the staff. Phenomenal program. If any of you are able to go visit it, I would highly encourage you to do that.
Great.
There were some other services that we were able to provide or had to cut back on or decided not to with the reductions, as Representative Greenlick brought up. We had respite care, and I think Dr. Murphy did a great job talking about just the desperation and the kinds of problems and co-occurring issues that happen when a person has a problem gambling. So literally people need respite care. Family members are pretty desperate as well. You heard one example. There's a lot of different examples of people that have spent their entire savings, and not only savings, gone into significant debt. So when Tim talked about hypertension, other kinds of medical issues, a lot of these things are brought on by stress. You know, we know that there's a big, huge connection between stress and other kinds of issues, medical issues. So these folks are seriously distressed when they end up seeking treatment. So slide number 5 basically gives you a pie chart of the budget, and it's a fairly simple, straightforward allocation of where these funds go. Again, for the 09-11 biennium LAB, we have $11.5 million. Most of that is dedicated to treatment services at $7.2 million. $2.5 is dedicated to prevention. I already mentioned how we integrate with other prevention systems. And we also, as part of the program support and admin, we contract with Hubert and Lewis to do some data analysis for us. We actually accept claims or encounter data for gambling addiction treatment, so we know how much service somebody is getting to the individual. We can track that. We also know the average cost of gambling treatment is only just a little over $2,000 per person, which is a very good value, I would have to say. Of course, it's a little different probably for residential. It's a little higher. So I've already alluded to slide number 6 that gave you the historical LAB dating back to 9901. Three times you'll see that that fund has been used for other purposes, so we didn't get to use the 1%. The treatment enrollments you will see on slide 7 essentially mirror what the funding is. I tried to do a fancy graph, but I'm not very fancy with my technology. But using a line on this other graph, you could literally see how that matches up for treatment enrollments. Slide number 8 provides you with some of the data that our data team prepares for us, or the contractor that we use. Interestingly, more than 50% of the folks who access treatment are women. Gambling, we have been told, and I happen to associate with a lot of people in recovery, and I've been told that it's a great escape. So when people have other issues or problems going on in their life, whether it be children, boredom, It's a phenomenal escape, and it works for a little while. But when somebody develops a pathological problem, it stops working like it used to. And then people use gambling and possibly other substances to escape the harsh realities that this addiction is causing them, which, as I mentioned, getting into significant debt, spending all of somebody's resources, losing their home, that's pretty serious. But unfortunately, it doesn't stop people from continuing to gamble. So you'll see basically the average household income, 40% are married. Most of these folks go to a lottery retailer as their primary location for gambling, people who access treatment. Video poker is the most popular form of gambling. And debt, I would just point out, we actually had a person who reported they were over $1 million into debt when they entered treatment, which for me, I know probably most of us in this room can't even imagine that. I can't imagine that. I don't like to lose $5. I rarely gamble. I don't even like to play. It just makes me nervous to lose a couple dollars. I work hard for my money.
That reminds me of, so I've got to tell you the story about the son of a friend of ours who was an attorney, worked for a very big firm in Portland, multimillionaire, lost his home. He had two homes, lost his home, lost his job, and is probably in debt over $1 million. This is a wonderful family, wonderful background, wonderful education, but just when you're sort of caught up this, and you would never, if you saw this person, you would never imagine this person would be in debt. And then finally was selling drugs so he could get money for his gambling, and what had gone to jail because of that, and then got treatment because he'd gone to jail for this. So it's just a horrible addiction.
Mm-hmm. What, Co-Chair Gilliam, would you like to share as well? No.
I guess not.
Now we're curious.
So, yeah. I don't want to. Okay. So, I would say that because some of my social circle know what I do for a living, I often have people come to me and ask me for help or for resources or what do I do. And I've had a number of people ask me or tell me that their loved one was suicidal, had attempted suicide unsuccessfully, thank goodness, and they were needing help for a gambling problem. So suicidal ideation and problem gambling, unfortunately, all too often go hand in hand.
One of the things we heard in a previous hearing was the shame that goes along with this. People, certainly even our caucus, will talk about that their friends have bills and they're in recovery. But I bet none of us knows anyone in our caucus, and I bet there is someone. I'm not looking over here. But who is recovering from, I don't mean that as a joke, and I apologize. But, you know, there is some shame that goes with this, whereas I think there isn't the same kind of shame in these days for people who have been addicted to alcohol.
Madam,
and sure. You've talked in earlier about your father having had a
well, he didn't have a gambling problem. No,
a drinking problem, yeah, but there was no shame in you talking with us about that.
Well, and this is something we see with lots of people. I think something we have to decide, though, is as a state, we've become addicted to the money and the gambling ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I could quit any time.
There's two of us that would vote to get rid of the lottery. Is how many more people?
I would vote, yeah.
I would. I even plan for us to wean ourselves off it using good.
Yeah.
We are addicted as a state.
Well, there's five.
Representative Thompson.
I had dinner some time back with a couple of district attorneys, and they made the remark that most, if not all, the white-collar crime they prosecute is gambling-oriented. Do you see those people, or do they just end up in the penitentiary, or is it...
We have Representative Thompson, co-chairs. We absolutely do see those people. And what you were referring to earlier, Representative Tomei, we have people presenting that look like June Cleaver from, and we have the whole social spectrum that comes in, and that's different than in our substance abuse clinic. That tends to not have that wide breadth of representation from socioeconomic classes. But the gambling seems to be affecting everybody. We work collaboratively with corrections, and we'll provide it because corrections doesn't have the ability to do the treatment. So we'll do the treatment for folks, and pending sentence or as they're finishing up their time in the institution, they may come to us for gambling treatment so that they, when they reenter society, they're not carrying around that same sort of addiction.
Actually, if I may touch on something, because we're focused on lottery, but bingo is a big thing as well, and I'm just wondering, I mean, I think that could be is bigger than lottery, and I just kind of want to get your guys' feedback on that, because I know I've been to bingo halls, have an in-law who basically that's where all their money went, all their social security and everything all the time.
Really?
Was into that. So it was on my wife's side, but that's even my youngest son, it's like he loves bingo. You know, he'll sit at Yamhill Derby Days and just play bingo all day on the hopes that he's going to win something, you know. And that's his goal, and they forget, don't count the cost of what's going away. So I'm just kind of curious how many people end up in the system through bingo, and if you're to compare lottery and bingo to each other, which one's bigger?
Well, I went to Catholic school, so I have a little bit of a problem answering that question.
If it means anything to you, I called bingo numbers for the knights.
For the parish.
So.
Yeah. It's a huge deal. It really, but I mean, I almost think of it as a starter drug. The people that get sideways, that end up with the suicidal ideation and that are the medical compromised presentation that we see, are video poker players almost exclusively. But that doesn't mean they didn't start playing bingo. I think bingo's an issue. It doesn't get diagnosed as much and come out as much in the interviews and the assessments that we do. But
Representative Widener, I was I don't usually divulge much personally when I'm up here talking to you, but I have recently, I guess, taken responsibility for another child. She's 18, so she's not a child. But the family has been devastated financially because of bingo. And it's no longer a good place for her to live, because mom is always gone at bingo. And since I've known this family, the car's been repossessed. There's been, you know, not groceries in the home. The home doesn't get taken care of. Kids don't get taken to school. Mom's up too late playing bingo, so she's sleeping until 3 in the afternoon. So it, from my perspective, just because my own personal life right now, bingo's pretty damaging also. And that's not the only thing going on. This community, I live here in this community. There's an interesting connection also between bingo and methamphetamine in this community. And when people take methamphetamine, they're awake. And, of course, they have that dopamine surge already going on. And you've probably heard people talk about needing to be busy when they're high on methamphetamine. So you've probably heard the stories about people taking apart radios, taking apart cars, just doing something to be busy. So this bingo, you know, you'll see people with sheets. Mm-hmm. I mean, they'll buy just sheets, and I don't know how they do it otherwise. I couldn't sit there and do it. But they're just busy doing bingo and being high on methamphetamine. So it's curious to me. I don't know, you know, I don't personally have any studies that connect those two drugs. But as Dr. Murphy said, cocaine, methamphetamine, and gambling tend to act in the same way on the brain with the dopamine surge and the synapses.
Absolutely.
So it's curious to me, and I won't say any more at the risk of divulging more personally.
It's interesting they put bingo in there. A friend of mine who's a meth counselor told me once that his very common for meth patients to throw darts, and that she's had numbers of patients that will throw darts for 14 to 24 hours constantly. Mm-hmm. Just same kind
constant
of behavior.
Activity.
They've mm-hmm. got to have something going, you know, and they just keep doing it.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to touch on, because you asked Chair Tomei earlier about effective outreach approaches. One thing that we've done in the last year is we integrated all of our administrative rules for substance abuse treatment, mental health, and gambling. And when we did that, we required all the addiction treatment programs and the mental health programs to screen also for gambling problems that hadn't been required before. As we know, this issue co-occurs with other issues. So that's one strategy, is not the silver bullet. We also, as been mentioned earlier, we allow family members to come in to services. So not only people that have the gambling problem themselves, but family members, because they're desperate too. And they can eventually, many times, get their person steered into treatment, or their loved one steered into treatment as well. Also has been mentioned the ad campaign for the hotline. We do find that the ad campaign, there's a spike in calls to the hotline when that ad campaign is going. The problem is it's not going all the time. So if that ad campaign were going all the time, we might see a sustained number of calls to the hotline.
And why isn't it going all the time?
Chair Tomei Gilliam, so the lottery dollar, sorry, the lottery is responsible for managing its administrative budget, and we do have constitutional limitations on it. And the money that we provide for outreach comes out of that administrative money. So we, again, try to balance our expenditures, and what we find with the money that we've allocated, we have in past years been very successful with increasing the calls to treatment with our campaigns. As any kind of advertising, if we're on the air all the time, I'm not actually sure that you would see a continuous flow of calls, because people tend to not see something if it's out there all the time. So we put advertising on the air about 1 week a month, and then we pull back, and then we put it back on. And again, we try to adjust that based on what kind of calls we're seeing to treatment. We try to come up with new creative approaches, which is the other thing, that if you have a new creative approach trying to reach a different group, you'll see an increase in calls. So as anything the lottery does, we have to balance our expenditures with the transfers that we make. So we do try to be as effective as we can with the money that we feel is the correct balance for us to spend.
May I ask a question?
Yes, that's an agreement.
Is that information about only being effective 1 month, 1 week a month, sort of like the way the car companies do it and the tobacco companies today? Sort of they don't think advertising on a regular basis works, is that?
Co-Chair Tomei and Gilliam, Representative Greenlake, there's the study of advertising effectiveness is something that we look at continually. So we rely on research and our ad agencies and look at best practices to say, what is the frequency and the reach of your messages, to say, how often should you be on the air? So certainly it's the same science.
And that's why you only advertise the lottery 1 week a month?
So again, Chair Tomei.
Because people get bored seeing the lottery ads?
To go back to what the constitutional mission of the Oregon Lottery is to maximize profits for the state of Oregon. So we look at that as one of our tasks, and we try to balance the expenditures to put games in the market, promote games. That's our major responsibility. So we look at the expenditures related to the gaming to say our job is to maximize revenue. The balance to that is to commensurate with public good, which is where we look at responsible gaming programs. And again, it's all a balance to say what kind of expenditures should you make, what's appropriate. So it's.
May I follow, Madam Chair?
Follow up,
sure.
You would support a bill that allows you to only advertise lottery 1 month, 1 week a month? because I'd certainly be happy to put
Chair
that
Tomei,
in.
Chair Gilliam, Representative Greenlake, that isn't what I indicated. Our mission at the Oregon Lottery and my responsibility is to say we are going to maximize profits for the state of Oregon. In order to do that, we look at what kind of products the consumer wants to buy. So we try to have a broad range of products. Video lottery actually was something that the legislature asked the lottery to manage back in 1992. And when we look at those product mixes, the way that you have customers, that so you talk to them about your products or else they don't know what they are. So we use the money we have to try to, say, inform people about what types of games you have, and that we believe that is how we spend our money, maximizes our returns. So that's one of the equations, which what I was speaking to is people do forget if you don't talk about your products constantly. So you come in and out of talking about a product. If you have something new, you might advertise it. With responsible gambling, again, what we try to do there is say, are there particular at-risk groups, which, again, we look to DHS and Dr. Jeff Murata to say, these are particular at-risk groups. We try to create messaging that we think is going to speak to those people and put it in the marketplace in different ways to try to get their attention, and that we do use metrics to measure it.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you again for doing this. This is the second time that I've been through this, not exact presentation, but thanks to you for keeping the spotlight on. And the last time we talked about it, we talked a little bit about how an organization that is tasked to squeeze money out of wallets is also the organization to be attentive to those who are particularly vulnerable. So, you know, I think it's worth going over again. I appreciate Representative Greenlake's comments. You know, from a policy standpoint, perhaps the legislature needs to take a more serious look at this. I don't see us in the future, in the near future, getting rid of the lottery. I think we are addicted to it, but it's very complicated, and it's a very much part of our how we raise money in this state. But on this, on the other point, I appreciate what the lottery tries to do to address the issues that you brought forward for those most vulnerable. But I do not see the connection or the wisdom of the organization that is advertising for more participation to also be the agency that is warning folks about the dangers. I don't necessarily think it's a sane world that the state would have two different agencies doing that, but it's I don't know why it would be housed in the same agency. And if you want effective advertising, if you want effective communication, it may or may not be television classic ads, but we need to take a look at what is the right agency to communicate with those who are subject or vulnerable to being addicted. And the last thing I would say, have you ever seen a connection, because Oregon is not the only institution promoting gambling. Las Vegas is live and well. Casinos are sprouting up all over this nation. There are national lotteries. And we are all very fascinated with the idea of getting something for nothing. But I've never seen an ad. You see the ads of the people that are at the casinos? They are so incredibly happy. And have you ever been in a Vegas casino and seen anything but this? It's a very strange thing after that.
I agree. You make an excellent point. It seems like this is... Representative Thompson.
On page 12, could you comment on youth gambling? I assume sixth graders aren't gambling video poker in bars, but it seems like a pretty young age to have that high of a rate of gambling.
Co-chairs and Representative Thompson, yes, that was the last slide I wanted to actually draw your attention to, and you'll see gambling to the left-hand side. We, as I mentioned, we conduct the student wellness survey, and we actually survey now sixth graders and eighth graders and 11th graders. It is alarming to me that so many youth say they are gambling. There's access to so many things on the internet that kids are getting access to. And of course, you check the box, yes, I'm 18, or yes, I'm of age. Nobody's looking over the shoulder to make sure that's really the case. Kids are also playing poker. They're playing cards, and they're playing bingo. Unfortunately, we do have sort of a double-sided message about gambling. As Representative Gilliam said so eloquently, people look like they're having fun, they're laughing, they're having a great time. And we unknowingly, as adults and parents, sometimes even sponsor children to have bingo parties and poker parties. And we think there's nothing wrong with it. And it may be that a kid doesn't end up having a problem. But if it's a kid that's predisposed, that realizes, oh, this dopamine thing is pretty great, you know, I'm going to move on and try other things. Yes, so they're getting access to things. They're not going into bars and playing. I'm assuming they're not going into bars video poker, but they have access to a lot of gambling through their peers and sometimes their parents.
Okay, so I fall into this. I dare my younger boys that if they go pick on, I'll bet you won't go hit Ray in the back of the head or something like that, knowing they're going to get beat up by him and things like that. But, I mean, that sort of leads to it. Or bet you a dollar you won't jump off the roof onto the trampoline. And
I see we have to go. We have a lot of discussion about taxing vulnerable populations, and it's no question in my mind that the lottery is a tax on people who are mathematically challenged. And it seems to me sort of unfair. It's a something-for-nothing problem. That,
I wonder if this, would anybody be interested in doing maybe a subgroup during the interim? That maybe
yes.
Well, we're also committed to doing taking this issue up in the Health Committee as an interim project, Representative Thompson.
That's terrific. Good. And would you bring the studies back here? Because I think this bears a lot more time on this issue. Thank you so much for
coming.
Thank you
very much.
Sorry to cut you all short. Thank you very much.
Finally.
With that, I will close the House Committee.